Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Professor Niall Moyna on how to age well and the role of movement. The food medic, Hazel Wallace, on her latest book, Not Just a Period. And Zoe Ryan is itching to tell us about psoriasis. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, the whirlwind continues. House hunting. We have a bid in, so do light a candle for us. Exams for my son and trying to help him through that. Light another candle for us. The usual juggle. The style awards were thrown in there. And then my laptop almost lost 6,000 words of my book. But we got through it. And as the saying goes, it could be worse. Getting me through this, I am clinging to my 10 minutes of breath work in the morning and my 2 workout classes a week. Movement is so good for the mind, but my shoulders are up around my ears and I'm doing my best to bring them down. A bank holiday weekend could not have come at a better time, and most of it is being spent on the down low. And it was lovely to hang out with my best friends this week. It was a confirmation celebration and a reminder of the importance of connection. You'll remember that was the theme of World Mental Health Day this year. And to just meet the people that we love and to kick back, catch up and have a laugh is truly very good for the soul. I want to mention an event I have coming up in Howth Castle in Dublin, right on my doorstep, one of my favourite places. And I'm bringing my Go With Your Gut Health event there. It is Sunday, the 22nd of June. It is from 10 till 3:30. We'll go on a moderate hike. It's only a small hike, but it's such a beautiful part of Howth. We'll come back to the castle, to their cookery school, where you will learn how to cook gut-friendly recipes. And it's beautiful. I was there actually last weekend with my daughter making sushi. It's the old kitchens of the castle that they have made into a cookery school. So you're hands-on with the chefs. We'll then get to eat what we make. We will have breath work with my good self and then a talk with a special guest. So to find out more, you can go to hothcastlecookeryschool.ie or you can go to my Instagram at Claire McKenna Presents. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. But now, as the global population continues to age, the phenomenon of longevity is reshaping our understanding of life, health and well-being. Experts are exploring the secrets behind living longer and healthier lives. Professor Niall Moyna is Professor of Clinical Exercise Physiology at DCU's School of Health and Human Performance, and he joins me on the line now. Niall, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Claire. Lovely to be with you.
I said the secrets behind living longer, but you've been shouting about this for quite some time.
We have known for some time that probably the best secret of aging is actually exercise, and more so your physical fitness. It really is a excellent determinant of not just how long you're going to live, but also of the quality of your life. And I suppose there's a term that I like to use. It's called eudaimonia. It's an Aristotelian term. It relates to flourishing or fulfilling a person's potential, you know, as a human being. And as we age, that's what we want to do. We want to flourish. This notion that, you know, you get to retirement age of 65 and then all of a sudden your life waves away. I think we need to change that paradigm. They should be the healthiest, most productive years of your life.
You use the term fitness there and exercise, but I find them to be quite broad terms. So what do you mean when it comes to that?
Well, exercise is when, well, maybe let's step back. Let's differentiate physical activity to exercise. So physical activity is any body movement other than lying or sitting. So if you're standing, any form of movement at all, that's being physically active. You're burning more calories than you would if you were resting, either sitting or lying. Whereas exercise is discretionary, planned, structured physical activity. So it's purposeful. You actually plan it. That's the difference. Now, some people, when you mention the word exercise, they just switch off. That's not me. That's for sports people, et cetera, et cetera, because that's planned, structured activity. But, you know, going walking around the garden, doing the gardening, taking out the wash, doing simple activities of daily living, you've been physically active, you're burning more calories than you would at rest, and you get significant benefits from actually doing that. So that So it's important to be able to differentiate between that. Then when it comes to physical fitness, again, physical fitness for health is very different to physical activity, say, for sport. And basically, the definition that we use in academia, that it's basically, it's a state of being that reflects your ability to perform, say, specific exercises or functions, like going to the bathroom, walking up a flight of stairs, and it's related to both your present and your future health. And there are four components of health-related fitness. They are cardiovascular fitness, that's your heart and your lungs and your muscles, maintaining muscular strength and endurance, maintaining ideal body composition so you're not losing muscle, and then good flexibility and balance. They're what we refer to as the four health-related fitness components. And it's important to maintain them throughout life.
And I think when people hear the term fitness, they think they have to be ready to run a marathon, but that's not necessarily true either.
You hit the nail on the head. That is so, so, so true. This is not about performance. This is about your overall health. Now, one of the things, particularly as we age, people think we hear every day about the steps and the 10,000 steps, and that's another issue. But one of the things that the current guidelines in Ireland recommend is that as we age, that we do some form of resistance training, that is to maintain our muscle. Because after the age of 30, we tend to lose 8 to 10% of our muscle per decade. And importantly, women, because they start to lose, they don't put on the same amount of muscle as men up to the age of 30. They don't have the same levels of testosterone. So they start to lose their muscle from a much lower level. And the likelihood is they will lose so much muscle that they will become frailty and lose their independence much earlier than men. So women tend to switch off when I start talking about muscle and resistance training. It is probably more important for women that they initiate or maintain at least 2 days a week, I would say 3 days a week, of some form of resistance training. And that can be done at home doing simple bodily weight exercises or actually going to a gym.
And I think that's key to the messaging, isn't it? That it's simple, consistent and often. You don't necessarily have to take up CrossFit or, you know, go to Berlin to do HYROX. As fantastic as these endeavours are, it's small and often that's important.
Well, you know, it's different strokes for different folks. And the vast majority of us do not engage in physical activity as we age. And you hit the nail on the head. The key word is consistency. And that means going out and maybe, and there's clear evidence now that we don't need to do near as much exercise as we thought we needed to do to maintain our overall health as we age. But the key is to be consistent. Get your daily walk or your daily cycle in, and maybe 2 or 3 times a week, do some form of resistance exercise, whether it's doing a push-up against a wall, doing heel raises on the stairs, whatever the case may be. Go into Google, look at exercises. You can't go wrong, but doing it consistently. If you're doing 15, 20 minutes a day, you do it 365 days a year, I can guarantee you there is no drug in the pharmacy that will come close to giving you the benefits of that much activity.
I think when people hear the term aging as well, it's something they kind of kick down the road. Whereas your message is very much from the age of 30 on, what you do from 30 to 50 impacts how you'll be beyond that.
Well, I would actually go beyond that, because chronological and biological age are two different constructs. We have data here in DCU from looking at the blood vessels of teenagers in Ireland, showing that they have a vascular age of between 55 and 60 if you're inactive and you have low fitness levels. So it's not just you. Yes, you can reach your peak at 30 and then it starts to wane. But many of us start to age well before that. But anyway, if you get to 30, that's when you start specifically biologically. It's ingrained in all of us, our genetics. We are going to lose muscle mass. So, and again, it's a bit like compound interest. Put on as much muscle as you can during your midlife, because you'll get okay to around the age of 60, 65, then you'll see a precipitous drop. So the higher it's falling from, the more muscle you have, the longer the time it will be before you reach frailty. And hopefully, very, very few of us should ever reach frailty. That's the reality here. We want to compress our ill health into the last months of our life, not into the last decade or 2 decades of our life. So again, I can't emphasize it enough, doing a little bit and doing it often.
And it's clear something else that helps you stay young, Niall, is that you have a passion and a purpose in life. You're always such a great voice in this space, and it's always a pleasure to have you on. Niall is giving a talk on fitness and aging well at the Age Well Expo. It's on Wednesday, June 11th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Talbot Hotel in Stillorgan in Dublin. It's free to attend, and you'll find out more at dloreventsevents.eventbrite.ie.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Zoe Ryan knows firsthand what it's like to live with psoriasis, but her personal diagnosis became a turning point, leading her to challenge stigma, reclaim control over her skin, and support others in a similar situation through her online platform. She joins me in studio now. Zoe, you're very welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Claire.
Tell me a little bit about getting the diagnosis.
Yeah, well, I suppose my journey with psoriasis started when I was 18, and that was when I got the official diagnosis of the condition. Now, it's suspected, looking back on my medical records, that I may have actually had the condition from a younger age and that it was misdiagnosed as similar presenting conditions. But I would also consider that my life with psoriasis really started when I was 18, because that's obviously when it was first said to me that I had it. And to this day, I'm still shocked whenever anyone mentions psoriasis that they know what it is, or if it's mentioned on something. Like, I was watching a stand-up comedian the other day and they mentioned a joke about psoriasis. And I'm just, even in this day and age with the line of work that I do as an advocate and an educator of psoriasis, I'm still shocked when people speak about it, because I didn't know about it. When I was first diagnosed, I'd never even heard of the condition, never mind know how to manage and cope with it. So to this day, it's still a surprise to me. Even waiting today in the waiting room, someone said to me, oh, I actually have a family relative who has psoriasis. And we're talking about how it's so much more common than people actually think it is. But I think that all just feeds back into the fact that with a condition that visually impacts you, and in a way that doesn't fit that social norm or that beauty standard that everyone achieves to, there is this level of embarrassment and shame that comes with it. And that leads to people not talking about it, which has that knock-on effect of, like, that people don't know that there's other people out there living with it, and that there's just generally a lack of awareness and knowledge of it.
So what is psoriasis, and what are the signs and symptoms?
So psoriasis is an inflammatory autoimmune condition, and it's very commonly miscategorized or misreferred to as a skin condition, because the main symptom of it is that it leads to markings on the skin. So that's why a lot of the time it'll be categorized as a skin condition. But as I said, it's actually an inflammatory autoimmune condition. So essentially what that is that our immune systems don't function as they should. To put it very basically, our immune systems are meant to protect us from the bad things. With someone with psoriasis, our immune system, it overreacts, it misfires, it can't determine good and bad. So it just is always in this fight or flight attacking mode. And that results to an overproduction of skin cells on the skin surface. And that's where we get the markings, the lesions on the skin. So that's basically what psoriasis is. But it's so much more than the skin, because the skin is just what we can see presenting on the outside. But as I said to you, it's this like internal flame inside us, this inflammation within the body that has a knock-on effect. It is a systematic condition that affects other organs in the body, not just the skin.
So up until the age of 18, when you got your diagnosis, what had you been experiencing?
Well, when I was quite a young infant, I had had what my parents were told was a severe case of eczema as a child. So I also remember, like, I was very young at the time. I would have only been a toddler. And I remember to this day, my older sister lovingly refers to me as Red Rasher, because seemingly I used to run around the house without pants on to let the air at the skin that was very much inflamed on my thighs and around my groin area. And to me, the only memory of it really is the heat. I always remember lying in bed at night and the sheets were sticking to you, because the skin resembled like raw meat. Now, if it is, in fact, it was psoriasis, that would be the inverse psoriasis, which tends to not have that layer of scale over it. So with the most common presenting of psoriasis, you tend to have a layer of scale over a layer of inflammation. But with inverse psoriasis, that layer of scale isn't there, because it tends to be in areas of the body where you have presence of sweat, like in the kind of creases of the skin. So for me, that's what I would have known as a child. Psoriasis is this type of condition that it does what they say is wax and wanes, which means it comes and goes. With anybody who has psoriasis, they'll know that the form of psoriasis you have, where it presents on the body, the severity of the condition can change throughout your lifetime. So it's suspected that that's what's happened with me, that when I was a very young child, I had a form of psoriasis that then kind of died down in its symptoms and it went into a remissive state. and then crept back up then when I was around 7. I presented with what was told was athlete's foot at the time, which it's now believed that could have been inverse psoriasis, is another location in between the toes. And then when I was in my teenage years, I got plaques underneath my arms. And it was around the time that I started shaving. So when a doctor looked at it, they were like, it's probably just razor burn from starting to shave. But now as someone who's had psoriasis for over 10 years, I recognise the plaques. And I know myself that they were plaques of psoriasis that were actually underneath my arms. But like that, they probably just came and went in different forms throughout my life. But it was when I was 18, I got quite a severe case of psoriasis that was presenting on my scalp area. I suppose at that stage, it was undeniably psoriasis. So they were like, well, this is definitely psoriasis. And as I said, it was just when they were looking back over the records, they were going, but from the notes here, it's probably a case that you did present with psoriasis at a younger age. But because psoriasis isn't very commonly seen in children, there's two kind of life stages where psoriasis first commonly presents. And that's in the kind of late teenage to 25 type of age frame. And then again, in your kind of 40s, 50s. So when we'll say there will be hormonal change for both men and women, very commonly in the kind of menopause for women. But outside of that, they don't really see psoriasis presenting in children very commonly, but it does happen. But for that reason, they're thinking it probably wasn't on their radar that you had psoriasis. With psoriasis as well, there's what they call a familial link, which is that for to have psoriasis, you have to be born with a certain combination of genes to be predisposed to having it. So it's basically a case of anybody who has psoriasis, you're born with the genes to have psoriasis, and then something along the way ignites the psoriasis when you're within your body. So you come encounter with an environmental factor that can be a stressful or traumatic event, injury or damage to the skin, coming on or going off certain medications, etc. And that ignites that first instance of psoriasis. And then from then on, your psoriasis is lifelong. But as I said, there could be stages in your life where you go to a near remissive state or even go into a fully remissive state, and it can come back in a different location or form. At that stage, my father has psoriasis, but he hadn't presented with it yet. He presented with it in the later stage in life. So he was, I think it was around his 50th birthday when he presented with psoriasis. So I suppose if you're looking at a child who has these lesions on the skin, looks very like other conditions like eczema, which it's very commonly misdiagnosed as well, you're probably thinking it's probably eczema. So let's treat it as eczema.
So that means topical treatments that presumably don't work, or do they provide some relief?
Yeah, well, the thing is that there's a number of different treatment routes with psoriasis. As you said, the topical applications will be the first line of treatment in most cases. It depends. If you have certain types of psoriasis that need a little bit more robust treatments, they might jump straight to that. But with most cases and forms of psoriasis, the first line of treatment would say, let's try the topicals, let's see if they work. So that's why I suppose at that time, after a couple of years, it did clear up quite effectively. And as I said, went into a remissive state for a number of years.
But what was the psychological impact of that? Because you didn't know when it was going to come back. When it came back, it obviously caused you discomfort, but you also touched on societal expectations, wanting to fit in, our beauty standards. Yeah. How did you navigate through all of that?
Well, up until I was 18, as I said, I wasn't aware I had this condition. I suppose it didn't really start to impact me until, as I said, I was 18, I was doing my leaving certificate. I didn't have time to be thinking about this. I was very studious and I was very just ingrained in getting through the exams. So it was when I went to college then and throughout my early 20s, when I was first diagnosed with psoriasis, my way of coping with it was, I was just in such disbelief that this was happening that I said, no, I refuse to believe that this is what they're saying that it is and that it's incurable. Surely not. And I went into the state of, as I said, disbelief and just refusing to believe that it was happening. And I suppose when I first decided to tell my story, as I am today, when I first decided to tell it, I actually got quite emotional because for a number of years I'd been repressing a lot of the emotions that I had around it. It was like when I was in my early 20s, I didn't allow myself to let it get to me and let it get me down. But unconsciously I was. So what would happen would be I was on a treatment plan where you had to apply all these topical applications for a period of time. It was quite, what would you say, that, you know, with any of the treatments, the hardest part of this condition is undergoing the treatments. A lot of them, they're quite unpleasant. They're difficult to do yourself. You usually have to get someone else involved, which is obviously embarrassing. So my parents were involved in it because they were the only people that really knew about the condition at that stage that I would have confided in that I had it.
And what goes on in the treatment?
Yeah, so back then it was that I would have been provided with a topical application. It was a tar-based one, was the one that I was put on first. Sometimes you can get steroid-based applications as well, but the tar-based one was the first one that I was put on. And it involves that you have to very meticulously coat the entire area that is affected by the psoriasis lesions with this application and leave it on for a certain period of time. Overnight's always best because it obviously has a lot of time to marinate. And because at that time my psoriasis was very much isolated to my scalp area, it's obviously an area that I can't see very well myself. So that's why my mother or my father in later years would have had to do this meticulous thing of dividing out the hair. For anyone who knows me knows that I have quite a lot of hair on my head. It's thinned over the years because of the psoriasis, but back then I had a lot of hair. And they'd have to be combing out the hair, separating it, dividing into places, applying this application. And the thing is that you don't feel like or look like yourself when you're undergoing these treatments because, you know, you go by the mirrors and you look yourself and you think, who is that girl who looks like this slimy, greasy thing in the mirror? Like, you don't recognise the person that you are. And you have to sit there and you have to get it applied. And then, like, it may not seem like much to someone, but it's as if back then I didn't have time to have this condition. You know, I was very busy. I was going, you know, I don't have time for this. I'd come home at the weekends from college. I'd get my parents to apply the applications, do the process overnight, combing it out the next day, taking out the plaques that have been loosened and lifted, washing it out. And then I'd go back to college and I'd live my life and I'd pretend like it wasn't affecting me. But as the years went on, the lesions started presenting elsewhere on my body, outside of the scalp area, creeping down to my face, down the back of my neck, on other areas of my body. And unknowns to me, when I'd be going out, I would be covering up those plaques. But if you had have asked me back then, how did it affect you? I'd say, oh, not at all. It's fine. It doesn't matter. Whereas when I sat down and decided I wanted to tell my story, I got quite emotional about it. And people will see that the very first time that I decided to record myself talking about it, I emotionally broke down about it. And I wouldn't be a person who would quite show emotion in that way. But when I was looking at the edit, I said, this has to be kept because this is raw. This shows actually how it affects a person. Uploaded it online and started the awareness platform. The reason why I decided to start the awareness platform was I didn't know anybody up until that stage who had psoriasis. I was of the belief that I was very much alone in this journey, that no one else really had it. Because I said, people don't really talk about, you know, having the condition. So I wasn't aware that other people lived with this condition and that they had the same experiences of me. I developed a greater understanding of my condition and it allowed me to better accept it, to manage it, to live with it a lot better. So it's nice when people reach out to you and that you know you've reached someone else that now knows that they're not alone. Predominantly on Instagram at the moment, there's a Facebook and a Twitter as well. But hopefully in the next couple of months, you can see that official website will be emerging.
Zoe Ryan from at Itching to Tell You. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Dr. Hazel Wallace is known as the food medic on Instagram and she has been a guest, thankfully, on the show previously. We had a huge reaction last year to her brilliant book, The Female Factor, talking about women's health. So she's back. It's sort of on the same mission. I think her overall mission is to make medical advice more relatable to people and simplify it. And she's got the goods to back it up. But she's also got a real thing for women's health. And as she should, she joins me in studio now. You're very welcome, Hazel.
Thanks for having me.
And like I said, this book is a continuation almost of The Female Factor because you were contacted by so many people yourself, weren't you?
Yeah, I feel like it was just the tip of the iceberg with The Female Factor. And then it opened a much bigger conversation when it came to women's hormones, menstrual cycles, and women not feeling like they were getting the answers that they wanted from maybe their GP or in any books. Because I think we learn a lot about maybe periods in terms of what happens during that bleeding phase, but not much else. And I think there's been a huge movement with the menopause, which is so fab to see, but no one really teaches you about the other kind of how to live between the ages of 11 to 50 when you actually have a cycle and it impacts you every single day.
And how it impacts you is really important because there's a lot of misconceptions out there. We're going to get to some of them because I was really conscious of trying to make the most out of our time. The book is out now. It's called It's Not Just a Period: Reclaim Your Cycle, Harness Your Hormones and Take Control of Your Health. So, you know, to get the detail, and as I said, it's really relatable. It's really easy to read. It's not really dense, even though you've got the science and the research and everything there. It's actually a lovely, easy read.
But you touch on 5 points that I thought we'd bring up. And the first is the title of the book, that it's not just a period, it's so much more. So tell us a bit about why that was an important headline for you and the title.
Yeah, there's 2 reasons. The first is it isn't just a period, you know, it's a full cycle, 28 days or so, where your hormones are fluctuating every day. And that influences how we feel on almost every level in terms of how we sleep, our mood, our energy, how strong we feel in the gym, our nutritional needs, our gut health. And the second reason is because when it comes to our periods and just women's health in general, we're often told, well, it's just part and parcel of being a woman. It's just a period. It's normal. And a lot of symptoms that women experience are not normal. They may be common, but they're not normal. And there's so much we can do about that.
There's also so much negativity around it, isn't it? Even though it's such a natural part of life, it's given this bad reputation about pulling down our mood, about being painful. And that's something you also want to cut through, because painful periods aren't normal.
They're not normal. I mean, some cramping is to be expected, but very painful periods are not normal. Pain that's stopping you from going to work or university or school, or causing you from not doing the things that you normally do, so impacting your day-to-day life, is not normal. And the thing is, a lot of women put up with it. And when we look at the research as to why women often don't report this pain to their doctor, it's because they believe also that it's just part of being a woman, or they don't want to be a nuisance. And I think that's just so typical of women, isn't it? That we just don't want to be a nuisance. But this is your health, this is your body. And also, the thing is, there are things that doctors can do to help if you are having painful periods, or it could be that there's an underlying condition like endometriosis. So it's so important that we are speaking up about these things.
And the average wait time, certainly here in Ireland, is 9 years for an endometriosis diagnosis, which is just all kinds of wrong and can be hugely debilitating to people's quality of life.
Yeah.
And I was at the endometriosis conference here recently, and I saw that you interviewed on your own podcast, the brilliant Carla Cressy.
Yeah.
But at the endometriosis conference, I was asking the organiser, whose daughter has it and she has it, what's the biggest thing that upsets her about it? And she said it's that her daughter's not going to reach her full potential because she can't show up for school. She can't show up for her exams. It will impact what she goes on to do. So it's so far reaching. It's so much more than the stereotypical get a hot water bottle and take to the couch for a couple of hours.
Yeah, 100%. And it goes for, you know, women who don't have endometriosis but have debilitating cycles in other ways, like PMS, PMDD, other menstrual issues, even those who don't have conditions but also just feel like either confused or feel like their hormones are causing havoc in the way that really bad cravings or constant breakouts or terrible bloating. There's so many different ways that our cycles influence our bodies, and not understanding why causes a lot of confusion, but also a lot of self-blame, like, oh, it's probably because of the food I ate, or, you know, it's very easy to blame yourself when something goes wrong, as opposed to look inwards, like what's happening in my body.
And you went through this yourself. You speak in the book, and I know you've spoken on your Instagram about it a lot, about your journey with PCOS. And as a medical doctor, you had to really fight for that diagnosis and to be heard.
Yeah. So it took me 2 years from going to the doctor the first time to actually getting the diagnosis, which seems long to me, but also in the grand scheme of things, when you hear women wait 8 to 9 years for an endometriosis diagnosis, isn't that long, but it's still not acceptable. And I was told that I didn't fit the PCOS picture initially, and so he wouldn't do any blood tests or an ultrasound scan, which is what you use to diagnose PCOS. And then eventually, after a period of time, I got the tests and I was diagnosed. And then I was just told to either go on the pill or come back when I wanted to get pregnant. And that is, unfortunately, the advice that a lot of women with PCOS are given. But there is so much more that you can do. And with PCOS specifically, and it's not true of all women's health conditions, nutrition and lifestyle plays a big role. And I now work with a lot of women who have PCOS as a nutritionist, and myself included, I've been able to get to a point where I don't really have symptoms because my cycles are regular now. But that advice is not given. It's you know, it's in our guidelines, but it's not given to women.
Before we get to that, I want to touch on the pill, because that was an interesting chapter to me, because the pill really is demonized.
Mm.
I only screen grabbed somebody, and I do think they were there was MD beside their name, but it was on Instagram, and they were like, you know, this is so dangerous. We are stopping women's natural cycle. And that's the kind of idea that you hear. That yes, on the one hand, it's not acceptable that this is the only option that's given to women without truly investigating what's going on underneath.
Yeah.
But the pill is not the big bad, the big bad enemy that it's put out as.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of fear mongering, especially online, when it comes to the pills and hormones in general, anything artificial. And I find that I'm often standing up for the pill and have been, you know, labelled as like a pill pusher by people on TikTok, which I absolutely am not. But I'm pro-informed choice when it comes to hormonal contraception and women's bodies in general. And I've seen firsthand at how, for some women, the pill has allowed them to continue with work because they've had really debilitating periods and it's helped with that, or their acne, or their mood. But I have seen, on the other hand, how the pill has been really harmful for some women's mood or their libido. So I think the nuance isn't there online. The pill isn't inherently bad. Yes, it carries risks, side effects, and it carries risks. And I don't think women get the full counselling they deserve from their doctors in that 10-minute appointment when it comes to going on the pill or any form of hormonal contraception. But I think labelling it as terrible for everyone is actually going to do women a disservice. And I actually think the pill's been quite transformative for a lot of women. So it really depends. And I think if you are on the pill and it's not serving you, or it's causing side effects and the benefits aren't, you know, weighing up with those risks, then you're by all means come off it. You know, I think it's like with any medication, we have to weigh up the risks and benefits. But I do think there's a movement going back to women wanting to feel their full cycle themselves. And obviously, if you're on hormonal contraception, you're blunting that cycle that you would have with a natural ebb and flow of those hormones. But before you do decide to come off it, like, have a think about, is this something that you want to do? Do you have something else lined up? What does that mean for your kind of the benefits that you received? Because I think it's very easy to blame the pill for the cause of all our problems, when for some people it gives them some benefits.
And I do see that a lot. It's almost like health is in one corner and wellness is in the other, and that there's big bad pharma in one corner and the holistic natural route, in inverted commas. But if it's going to be truly holistic, these things need to be complementary, and science and evidence-based practice is 100% the way to go alongside the lifestyle factors.
Yeah, that's it. I think, like, I've never been it's this or that when it comes to medicine and nutrition and lifestyle. I think it's they complement one another, and PCOS is a really good example of that. But also other women's health conditions, like even going through the menopause, nutrition and lifestyle is hugely important because you've lost estrogen. So you need to be like looking after yourself in terms of, you know, your bone health, your heart health, your brain health. And I just think, like, women are at this point, I think, where we're a bit fed up with the lack of research and are starting to take it into our own hands and just want to find out more answers to what's going on in our bodies.
So let's talk about harnessing those hormones then, and the lifestyle factors that can play a huge role.
Yeah. So our hormones impact everything. We talk about estrogen and progesterone as hormones that impact how fertile we are when we ovulate or our periods, but they influence everything. There's receptors all over our body. So our sleep, for example, our mood, our muscle building potential, our gut health. And understanding that can be hugely beneficial for women. So, you know, if we take nutrition for an example, there is research to say that nutrition can help with menstrual symptoms. So menstruation or your period is hugely inflammatory. And so, and inflammation, by the way, is not a bad thing. It's a good thing because it helps our body heal. But it does come with really awful symptoms like bloating and pain and swelling and redness and heat. They're the symptoms of inflammation. And nutrition and anti-inflammatory diet can help with easing that and preventing painful periods to a degree. But the other kind of side of the coin is our cycles can also influence our nutritional needs. And we see this in the luteal phase, which is the second part of the cycle before the period. And during this time, we get an increase in our metabolic rate. So the amount of energy that we use at rest, we all have metabolisms. But what this means is we are actually using more calories to just do our day-to-day living. And often women feel more hungry during that time. They crave certain foods. And naturally, we eat a little bit more during that time. And that's all normal. It's just our bodies being intuitive. But I think, as with anything when it comes to calories or food, when we're women, we really demonize those feelings. But I actually talk a lot about in the book about leaning into that and being more proactive with your nutrition during that time if you're someone who really struggles with cravings. Some women even go as far as struggling with binge eating during that time because the hormones really influence that hunger. So it's about making sure you're having those regular meal times, not skipping meals, and making sure that the meals that you're having are balanced with your complex carbs, your fats and your protein. And try not to give into that, you know, voice in your head that says, oh, I shouldn't be hungry. I've just had lunch. You know, it's OK to be hungry.
Yeah, 100%. And to go with those feelings or to be craving chocolate and but to feel like you're in control of it rather than it's in control of you. And I think that's really important. I also thought it was really interesting in the book about nutrition and your cycle as a fifth vital sign. And something we both have in common is over-exercising and dieting leading to the cycle completely disappearing.
Yeah.
We really need carbohydrate as women and to be eating well. And when we live in a culture obsessed with diet, that can be difficult. And often we think, well, let's look, it's one less thing to worry about. I know it didn't bother me at all until I started to look to get pregnant.
Mm.
But we should look at it as our fifth vital sign. If we're not getting our period, it's worth investigating.
100%. It's not normal or healthy to not have a period. And when I say that, I caveat that to anyone who's either pregnant, breastfeeding, or is currently on hormonal contraception that would stop their period. But for anyone who's not on contraception, if your cycle's disappeared, that's a big red flag. Something's going on, something's stressful in your body. And 90% of the time it is over-exercising, under-eating, or cutting big food groups, or one version of all of those. And, you know, I often see women come to me who maybe have been in that situation and they're working back to get their period back because they want to conceive. They may have reduced exercise or started eating more calories, but they're still not eating carbohydrates and your periods just aren't going to come back. But it's really important that we have that conversation because your carbs are important for hormone production and also thyroid hormone, which is your hormone that helps with metabolism as well and your energy. So it's so important as women that we're not cutting big food groups and we're not doing big gaps in the day where we're fasting as well.
Yeah. And if something happens like our cycle goes irregular all of a sudden or disappears, take that as a sign, take that as a message.
Yeah.
And explore it a little bit more. The moods that come with cycles is something that is huge and often in relationships can be weaponized against you, and you really delve into that in the book. And again, a lot of how we're feeling isn't necessarily our hormones.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've all heard it, like, you must be due your period because you're emotional or moody. And I think we always, when it comes to women, we always assume that the reason that we're expressing any form of emotion is because it's our hormones. And you and I both know that that's absolutely not true. But it's easy to do it to ourselves as well. And what I found really interesting in the book is, yes, hormones absolutely play a role in our mood and our emotions. We see that in women who have PMS and PMDD. But also, there's a lot of research to say that our physical health and also our relationships and our social connections have a bigger impact. And what that tells me is, like, yes, our hormones play a role, but look at the bigger picture. Like, is work super stressful right now? Is your partner not being very helpful around the house? do you have another physical health problem going on that's actually keeping you up at night? So there's so many other things that influence our mood that we just shouldn't blame our hormones. And I think it's great to have a partner who's involved in the conversation, but we shouldn't be weaponizing our hormones or just always blaming them. You know, it might be that, you know, they're actually the problem, not your hormones.
And it becomes something that you're masking then, isn't it? Because you're not investigating it further, or you're not having that conversation or taking that action or asking for that support, be it in your work or be it in your family or in your home.
Yeah.
Because you're saying, oh, it must be my hormones. So I think it's a really important conversation to have. And finally, to touch on how our cycle impacts how we feel about ourselves, because it's almost a subsection of that. And it happened to me so many times that I'd be filled with self-loathing, and then the next day, bang, it's my period. And I'm like, oh, that's what was going on. What's happening in our bodies when that happens?
Yeah, so the body image chapter was actually probably my favorite to write, because I think it's probably the least spoken about. And now we all experience, you know, issues with our body image or changes to how we perceive ourselves, let's just say. And that can be influenced by many things, you know, influenced by social media, influenced by our parents, influenced by what we see in magazines. But our cycles and our hormones also influence how we perceive ourselves. And most women who experience body image issues will find that it happens in that luteal phase before their period, where they feel like they look different or look bigger. And it's actually quite sad when you read some of the research, especially some of the descriptive research, because women use terms like, oh, I look like a whale, or they use like terms like animal terms. And I just hate that we think that way about ourselves. But one really interesting study found that even though women reported looking or feeling different during that time, when we measure them, the physical, like objective measures didn't change at all. So even though our body isn't changing, we think we look different. We think we look fat. We think we look whatever it is. But our body hasn't changed. So it's like our hormones influence how we perceive ourselves, and we just feel less attractive. But I will caveat that with some women do obviously get bloating or water retention during that time as well. So that can influence. But for majority of people, their body stays the same, but we just think we look different.
And that's why having this knowledge is empowering. I remember when, you know, discussions began about periods and harnessing it a little bit and knowing when your creative side time was, knowing when your energetic side was, knowing when to pull back. I thought that was a bit of a sign of weakness, because we're the only gender that has these times. And yet it is a power to know and to lean into that and to allow for that and to give yourself that break. Because if you get that thought and you look in the mirror and you say something and you think, actually, where am I in my cycle? Then you go, that's okay. And, you know, you're in control of it again. You're not letting your thoughts spiral.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, thinking about the body image kind of chapter and conversation, if we work to improve our body image, we can then therefore improve our relationship with our cycle, and we're less likely to feel those effects. But if you don't know why you're experiencing that, you're never going to be able to fix it. So I think it's so important that we have these conversations, and we don't just talk, or we don't even have the conversation anyway. It's often like in very hushed tones, tampon hidden up the sleeve. These conversations aren't often happening on mainstream media. And I think one of the things I really want to come out from the back of this book is that it does become normalized. Because if we don't talk about it, then we can't help women who are struggling.
I did see you post on your Instagram, The Food Medic, that the Irish have really shown up for this book, that you've had a lot of interest from media outlets. Has it been different in the UK?
Yeah, I would say in the UK, they've been slower to adopt it. And I was talking about this on another podcast where I think, you know, they were very happy to promote the female factor, but maybe when you have the title period on the book, some people don't feel comfortable having that conversation, especially the men in the room. And I get that some audiences are maybe an older demographic, and so it feels like it doesn't fit with them. But this book isn't for teenagers. This book is for any woman who's had a cycle, or any woman who knows someone with a cycle, or any person who knows someone with a cycle. And I think we forget that women go through menstrual cycles between the ages of anywhere between really 9 to 51, which is a huge chunk of our life. And that's, we go through it 450 times on average in that lifetime. So I think it's just funny to me when they say, you know, it's not our demographic, when I think, well, it's half of the population, but okay.
And I often would be very conscious on this show of being balanced and not leaning in too heavily to women's health, even though I want to, because it's underfunded, under-resourced and often misunderstood. But I want to make sure there's balance. But at the same time, women's health is everyone's health. Everyone has a partner, sister, mother. This is information for everybody, but ultimately it's for women with a cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's, I want more men and male partners and people who don't have a cycle to be involved in the conversation as well, because it influences them. And we see that in research, in like relationship research, when we look at the menstrual cycle and in couples therapy. So it's so important that you're having that open dialogue, because it impacts everyone.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say it's just a period. Let's talk about it, but it's not just a period. The name of the book, it's absolutely brilliant. I would highly, highly recommend it. Another brilliant book. Congratulations.
Thank
and
you.
I know you're super busy at the minute. I loved your post recently. Just a girl trying to plan a wedding, be faster, stronger, launch a book, run a business. But you do it all so well. Dr. Hazel Wallace, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And It's Not Just a Period is available now. So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Maurice O'Sullivan, to Rory Galvin, who was on podcasts and helping this week. Thank you to all my guests and to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.